How are you doing?
Doing all right. I'm just been fighting Toronto traffic this morning, so
Oh yeah?
you know how much fun that can be.
Oh my gosh, you know what? It's the best time ever.
Woohoo!
So you're in traffic right now. Whereabouts are you headed?
I'm just heading. I just got off on Islington. I'm going to the Sony Studios. I'm finishing a soundtrack for the next Tanya Talaga film,
Oh, no way.
and yeah, I'm going in to do a vocal on a song that I wrote for the movie. I did all the all the I create music that you never hear, but you would miss if it wasn't there. Basically, in I do. I mean, this is I got a couple more films coming up over the next 12 months. But I was so inspired by this film that I thought that I would write a song for it, and she loved it, and the producers loved it. And then I asked Tanya, she was coming home from the Cannes Film Festival, and I texted her over there, and I said, "Listen, I said this kind of needs your touch on this, Tanya. Would you mind thinking, if you could come up with a few lyrics?" Anyway, she wrote this lyric on the way home on the plane overseas, coming back to Canada, and now I'm going in to record our group effort
So
on make.
this is a bit of an exclusive then.
Yeah, for sure. It feels good. It feels good to be working. Oh, well, it's great working with her. I love her, and her work is absolutely phenomenal. And her intent is right, and her integrity is unnudgeable, you know what I mean? You can't deny the hard work that she does and the incredible work that she's doing. It's like it's great to be writing a song with the best-selling author in Canada. How's that?
There you go. What's the film about?
Film is about the first land back movement in Kenora, Ontario.
Oh, so is it more of a documentary or a theatrical?
Pretty close to it, yeah. Pretty close to documentary style, that's I'd say.
Cool. You say you're writing music like most of us breathe, you know. It just seems like an off the cuff kind of thing that you do. Where do you think
Well,
that comes from?
I think it just comes from a lifetime of doing it. I mean, anything that it's so funny that you say that off the cuff because, I mean, really, the creative process. I mean, we're all just making it up as we go along if we allow ourselves to. We've been trained, of course, through the education system and through governments and churches and corporations to not trust our instincts, to not trust ourselves. We're all 100% creative beings. We all have that desire in us too, that we kind of stifle that for common sense, and mine comes from that place. I actually my wife laughs at me because I am when I'm painting, I don't use a pen. I go right in there either with the oil and start painting, or I use a an oil marker, Sharpie style, to outline what I'm doing. She says, "You should be using a pencil." I said, "Well, I'm kind of committed to the moment." So being committed to the moment, I guess you could consider spur of the moment.
Yes, for a moment.
Yeah.
So I'm going to probably mess this up, but you've been making professional music since the early 80s?
I've been doing this for 50 years, since I was 16 years old. 1975,
Oh, wow.
I started playing my first gigs. I started playing in church, like most people do in that era. And then I started working, finding myself gigs in coffee houses and festivals and things like that. So it's it's been a long life of performing, I guess, you know.
So you say you started in church, like in Hamilton or
in Hamilton,
you,
yeah.
Did you just go out and like travel around to churches and sing?
Play. Oh no, I just played like at masses, you know. I mean, they had back then, they used to have things called folk masses and things like that, you know, where they would, you know, I don't know, I can't remember completely, but you know, like one Sunday a month, they would let the organist off the hook, and they would have the hymns performed or spiritual songs performed by guys with guitars and upright basses and things like that. I don't know. I haven't been to church for about 4 decades, so I actually don't know. I don't know if they still do that or not.
Yeah. No, I just found it interesting. Found it interesting. Now, do you think that education influences any other part of your music?
The church?
Yeah, like you starting out in church, that those cadences and whatnot.
You know, those things that we learn as a kid. You know, I mean, I've got a lot of respect for faith. I just don't really want to be going to church, and I'm not even going to get into that subject.
No, but I understand
the opportunity to be able to perform music, that desire overruled everything. So I found a little bit of a door opening, you know, in the church for me to be able to stand and perform, which is what I knew I wanted to do. And I was able to grow once I started getting out and playing. You know, I ended up in, you know, from the church to the bar room. You know, like Pop Staples, you know, Pop Staples dragged his daughters, you know, out of the church and into the bars, you know, because he said that's where the word needs to be heard. And whether that word is one from organized religion or comes from your own spiritual place, you know, we're looking to write and perform messages and songs that resonate with people. So, you know, it's been a lifetime of looking for an audience, and we continue, you know. I mean, you still see the greatest writers of our time, of our generation, out there still playing, still looking to have their material resonate with an audience, you know. Mm-hmm. It's a lifelong commitment, you know. I mean, it's not a, you know, the creative world, the performing world, the art world, is not something that is just in a class that lasts 60 minutes, you know, between math and chemistry. You know, it is a, it's a lifelong commitment, and one that I've been happy to be a part of, I'll tell you that much.
Mm-hmm. You speak of the great musicians, the great songwriters. Do you feel yourself in that category?
Oh, fuck no. I don't even consider myself an artist. I mean, I got paintings, you know, hanging in the McMichael Gallery, you know, which is about, to me, the most prestigious gallery in Canada. And I still don't consider myself an artist. I consider myself somebody working to be an artist. I feel like I'm working to every day to discover more about myself. So I think that road is going to be how I'm going to continue on that road, only because it's the only road I know. And once we start calling ourselves something, then we're kind of we're not doing ourselves any favors, you know what I mean?
So it's not about the destination, it's the trip.
It truly is, you know.
Okay,
that's good.
It's such a nice way of thinking about it. I would say that there are less talented people that would claim to be artists, and you're kind of the opposite.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, the angriest people, you know, and the most negative people are the people that are frustrated because they've decided that they're going to be something and didn't realize that the work that they do every day is what makes them closer to that. You know, I don't know if I'm explaining myself properly, but
no, I'm getting it.
I got asked the other day, which I have an art exhibit opening in Hamilton, and I was doing a TV interview, and the TV interviewer, you know, they don't have an opportunity like you do to actually have a conversation of any kind of depth, you know. So she said, I always steered away from the art world because it always seemed so snobby and pretentious. And I said, well, that's because the people who are snobby and pretentious are people that don't have the confidence in what they're doing, you know. Every day that I wake up, I want to create something that wasn't here yesterday. Okay. That might be something that is really amazing, or it might be something that's total shit. It doesn't matter. It's the actual execution of trying to make it happen, you know.
Okay, so you're learning by doing, you're creating by doing.
Yep, learning to crawl every day.
Yeah, that's good. You got a lot of history here, a lot of travel, I think.
Well,
you've done a lot of things. The junk house.
Yeah.
The Florida Razors. How'd you find yourself in Florida? Or is that just what it was called?
That's just what we called ourselves. We couldn't come up with a name. We were playing punk bars, playing rockabilly and rock and roll at Larry's Hideaway and The Edge and every punk bar from Detroit to Montreal. And we needed a name for the band. And we just put those two words together. I clearly did not think it out. But, you know, I mean, look at it. But it's 2025, and you're still mentioning the Florida Razors. So, you know what I mean? It was a band that was totally independent. We sold weed and speed and vinyl records out of the trunk of my car. I was kind of like the underbelly version of Colonel Saunders, you know, selling chicken out of the trunk of his car. So, I mean, that's how we survived. And of course, Junk House got signed in 1993 to Sony and started getting hits all over the world. And we were a bunch of knuckleheads from Hamilton that never expected to get off the 401. And they were sending jets for us and flying us to Scotland. And we were playing concerts in castles with Oasis and Jeff Buckley and all kinds of, you know, crazy, heady stuff that occurred during that time. And it was very short, you know, that world travel. Uh-huh. And, you know, since then with Blackie and the Rodeo Kings, I mean, I've also achieved things that I never even dreamed were possible. You know, I never thought that I'd be playing at the Ryman Auditorium on a Saturday night in Nashville, Tennessee for the Grand Ole Opry. I never dreamed that was possible. So the things that we, and at the same time, I never dreamed that I would write a book and it would become a bestseller. I never dreamed that there would be a film about that book. I never dreamed that I would have a piece of art in the McMichael Gallery. Those things are not things that I thought about when I was working and to create every day, you know. I'm 66 years old on Monday, and I've worked hard my entire life, and I'll probably keep on working until, you know, you come around and throw dirt on my grave.
So you're a group, you're a bunch of guys from Hamilton, and then you're suddenly whisked away to Scotland?
Well, you know, we were just out doing gigs, right? We were touring in Europe.
Right. But what does that do to you? Like, does it say to you that, hey, we're pretty good? Did you have that assumption beforehand?
I think I was pretty good. I don't know. I don't think that getting on a plane and flying to play in a castle in Scotland defines you as good or bad or, you know, somewhere in the middle. It's just something that happened, you know.
Okay.
Being good at what I do? I don't know. You know, I mean, being good at what I do, for me, consists of what kind of a vocal I'm able to do today here at the Sony Studios. You know, that's my job today. My job back then was getting on stage in, you know, Scotland and doing a show. My job back then was getting on a plane flying to Australia or Japan or Europe and playing one concert after another. There was nothing about that lifestyle that was healthy. You know, you stick old records and a bunch of Junos on yourself, and it's amazing how much people want to give you to tear you down. You know, they're either opening a bottle or sticking something under your nose or trying to have sex with you. And when you're in a vulnerable situation like that, you take advantage of it all. And I did, and I crashed and burned. And as Bill Withers said, the great Bill Withers said, it's amazing how good looking you get when you put a gold record on your wall. Which is a fabulous quote, and it kind of, you know, it kind of describes the situation perfectly, doesn't it?
It does. It does.
Drummer from Junkhouse lives in Belleville.
Is he?
Yeah, he lives. He's married to Astrid Young, Neil Young's sister.
Goodness sakes! Right here in Belleville.
Oh, yeah. Well, Neil just lives north of there, right?
Oh, does he? Of course he does. Driving his electric cars and
doing his thing.
Mm-hmm.
The rich is gone and hopefully happy as.
Good, good. So you've met all of these people that most of us would dream to meet.
I guess, you know, I mean, Junkhouse, hell, we toured with everybody from Bob Dylan to Green Day, you know, and it was everybody, you know, the thing about that life is that everyone's on the job, right? You know, you're picking up the phone and calling me and doing an interview. You're on the job.
Yeah.
You know, you could be sitting beside Ernest Hemingway or Oscar Wilde, and they'd be sitting there doing their job too. You know, you're a writer, you write. That's it's your job. So I mean, like musicians, or you know, hanging around with those people called superstars, it's everyone's on the job.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. But sometimes it's hard to think about it that way.
Yeah.
You know, there are people that sit back and listen to you and throw you like accolades and buy your records and everything. So that there's a bit of a difference between what you do and what, you know, the rest of us do.
Yeah, I guess you're right. You know, I mean, I don't downplay that. I just make a reality out of it, you know.
Yeah.
What am I doing here? You know, is this interview for the art show I'm doing down there or the concert?
No,
I'm doing?
It's the concert.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, we're going to get to the concert part. Sorry. I just wanted to get some other stuff in first. Some color.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I hope I'm giving you some color, you know.
You're definitely giving me color.
Good.
This is wonderful. We were talking about that. And so that comes to you. You've done all these albums. You've written books. You've had movies made about those books, a documentary. And now you're coming to the Regent Theater.
I love it. So it's a great venue. I've played there before. I've always loved that stage. And I'm bringing a chamber orchestra.
Okay.
And we're performing songs and readings that all have been inspired by or come straight out of the pages of my first book.
Okay. That'll be nice. Now, chamber music, the strings and
Four strings, five strings, percussion, piano, and reeds.
okay. And
So,
will you be playing at all? Or will you just be
yeah,
reading?
well, you know what? I'm on a stage with such fantastic musicians, I probably shouldn't play, but I might not be able to help myself, you know.
Where did that come out of? Where did I want to create a Mohawk symphony? Where did that come from?
Came out from looking for another avenue to be able to express myself musically, you know. And I guess I may have itchy feet, or I just might be into exploring new ways. I mean, it's why I ended up doing soundtrack music, is that I just started trying it out and loved it, right? Well, I hooked up with a guy named Darcy Heppner, who lives in Hamilton. And he was the he was a sax player for B.B. King for years. He was signed to Blue Note Records. And his father was the conductor of the Edmonton Symphony Orchestra, so he has this massive, generous background in being able to take my ideas and do, you know, write charts for them for strings, and we create a different sonic bedding for my vocals, for my singing and my reading.
Now, is everybody quote unquote Mohawk on, in the symphony, or is it just as a because you yourself are Mohawk and this is your
Yeah.
symphony?
You only need one Mohawk on stage at a time, and I am it.
Oh, okay. All right. So these are all very talented people, but not necessarily indigenous.
Well, how's this? They're allies. They're
Okay.
allies to my cause. You know,
They're
I
the
work with allies.
loyalists. Yes. Okay.
Yeah.
Cool. And that's happening on the 20th, 21st?
21st on Indigenous
June
Day, on
21st.
Indigenous.
Okay, great. I don't necessarily want to get into it, but this seems to be a bit of also color for folks who don't exactly know your story. But you found out at a later age that you were adopted, and that you were in fact Mohawk.
That's right.
Yeah. Can you tell that story, the synopsis of that story, the
Yeah,
story
sure.
that you like to tell?
Well, you know, I just get asked to tell it a lot, I guess, or people ask me to come out. You know, I mean, I talk about this. I lecture. I just the last time I lectured on this was at the Royal Museum in Regina. You know, it was a beautiful theater too. So I talk about identity. I only tell my own story. I tell my own story through my visual art, through the next book that I'm writing right now for Penguin Random House, and through my music. And some people identify me as a 60s scoop kid, which I could be. But most of all, it's about the idea of having your entire existence manhandled and your identity taken out of your control. I didn't know who I was until I was 53 years old, and a complete stranger told me that I was adopted. And then I lived shortly later, I found out that the woman who acted as my cousin my entire life was actually my mother, Mary Jane Lazar. She's Mohawk from Ganawage, and my father's Mohawk from Ganawage. And I joke, I grew up thinking I was a big, puffy, sweaty Irish guy my whole life. I turned out to be a Mohawk, and you know, basically from Ganawage.
That's interesting. And has that changed the way you write music? Do you feel that it's changed you in any way? Do you feel
It's a
you are
lot.
still the same person you were when you began?
No, I'm not the same person. I'm a better person, knowing who I am without identity. Without identity, what do we have to offer the world? If we don't know who we are, how can we go about making this a better world? It's very difficult. Now that I know who I am, I know what my blood is. It's freed me of the chains that have held me down. I've broken out, and now I'm able to work to create art and music that hopefully make this a better place for us to live in. And I'm able to use my voice to make people aware of the causes and the needs in this country. I'm also able to step out my front door and get arrested as a land defender, which I did a couple of years ago. So
Yes.
I'm motivated. How's this? In one word, I'm motivated, 100% motivated, and I hope to be motivated to the day I die.
Cool. All right. Now, are you at your destination?
My destination?
Sony Studios, are you there? Am I
Yeah.
taking you away from?
They'll wait for me, you know. They're all getting paid.
That's true, I suppose.
Yeah, I'm very respectful, but yeah, I'm just parked a block away right now. I'm just
Okay.
so that we can finish our
Okay.
chat and then I'll go to work.
All right. One last, I'm going to leave the last words to you that people out there who are younger people who are out there interested in creating in building a career in music, what would your words be to them?
Would lead with your heart would be all I can offer them. Don't expect anybody to understand what it is you're trying to do. And if we open up our hearts, we are going to make this a better planet. We can't rely, as I mentioned before, we can't rely on churches or governments or corporations to do the work for us. We're fools to think that those institutions are going to guide this world to a better place. But if we as individuals open up our hearts and show love and respect and courtesy to everybody we meet every day, then we're going to make this a better world. In fact, if we go out today and do that, we're going to make this a better world than it was yesterday.
Well, thank you, Tom.
Thank you very much. It was wonderful talking with you. And now I'm at my destination. So
Wonderful.
we worked out wonderfully, and I hope you have a great day.
I did want to have to ask you this, though. Do people
Yeah.
call you Mr. Wilson?
No. You know what? They call me Dr. Wilson
Oh, yeah.
because I'm a doctor now, and I'm also got the Order of Canada. So I don't know. You got a lot of monikers you can stick on me, but Tom would probably do you well.
All right. We'll just continue to call you Tom.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for this.
Take care, my friend.
You too. Thanks. Bye.
Bye.
Crown. saw an angel on the side of the moon. So keep your faith in total. The road is long, but the coast is far. It's hanging under the western stars. Lay your darkness down. Hang your sins on the phony crown. Yeah, yeah, dead or alive, every night we take that blue moon drop. Yeah, yeah, dead or alive, every night we take that blue moon drive. Why must push always come to shove?
it's already
Imagine waking up to the news that the bustling metropolitan city you live in is suddenly part of a newly recognized indigenous rights agreement.
Right. The literal roads you drive on.
Yeah. The roads, the parks you walk through, maybe even the actual land your house sits on.
It's a massive shift to wake up to.
It really is. You open your phone, you know, you scroll through the morning headlines and you see these phrases just jumping off the screen. Phrases like landmark deal or Aboriginal title.
And the map.
Oh, man, the map. A map that literally covers the entirety of your daily commute.
Yeah.
And if you live in Greater Vancouver, you really you don't have to imagine this scenario at all, because that is exactly the reality you woke up to recently.
It's been everywhere.
It has. So welcome to today's deep dive. Today is Tuesday, March 3, 2026. And our mission today is to cut straight through this recent wave of, well, frankly, confusing headlines and all the rising political noise.
There's a lot of noise right now.
So much noise. We are going to uncover exactly what the historic agreement signed between the government of Canada and the Musqueam Indian Band actually mean. What they mean for Greater Vancouver, for the country, and most importantly, for you.
Because it does affect you.
Exactly. And we have a really solid stack of sources to guide us today. We're looking at the official February 20 press release directly from Crown Indigenous Relations and Northern Affairs Canada.
Which is the raw data, essentially.
Right. But obviously, a press release only tells one side of the story, right?
Huh.
So we are pairing that with follow-up early March reporting from Post Media, the Canadian Press, and City News.
It really is a fascinating stack of documents to synthesize, because when you have highly polished government press releases sitting right next to, well, rapid-fire, somewhat panicked media reporting.
Very panicked in some cases.
Right. You almost always find this massive gap between the legal reality of what was signed and the public perception of what it means.
Absolutely.
My goal today is to bridge that gap. We're going to take these highly technical government documents and these breaking news reports, analyze them objectively, and find the so what for you, the listener.
We want to find the tangible stuff.
Exactly. The on-the-ground impact hidden beneath all those layers of dense legal jargon.
Okay, let's unpack this a bit, because if we start with the core facts from the February 20 announcement, there is a lot to get through.
There is.
The federal government and the Musqueam Indian Band didn't just sign one overarching document and call it a day. From what I'm seeing in the Crown Indigenous Relations release, they actually signed three very specific, distinct agreements.
Yes, three pillars, essentially.
Can you walk us through what those actually are before we get into the massive public reaction?
Absolutely. So the foundation of this announcement rests on those three pillars. The first is a Rights Recognition Agreement.
Okay.
This is a dense 30-page document. Its primary function is to officially recognize that Musqueam has Aboriginal rights, including title, within their traditional territory.
Right, the rights recognition.
Then the second is a stewardship and marine management agreement. This one is highly operational. It establishes bilateral collaborative working groups between the nation and the federal government.
Dang, down to the logistics.
Exactly. And the third pillar is a fisheries agreement. This involves shared decision-making regarding the waters.
Yeah.
But crucially, it also includes actual federal funding.
Wait, so they didn't just sign a basic let's get along charter here?
No, not at all.
Because when I was looking through the details of that second agreement, the stewardship and marine management one, it isn't just the Minister of Crown Indigenous Relations signing off. You have the Canadian Coast Guard at the table.
You do.
And you have the Minister of National Defense, David McGuinty, actively weighing in. They are focusing heavily on marine safety and emergency response. That feels like a massive step beyond typical diplomatic recognition.
It is a massive step. Mm. When you bring the Department of National Defense and the Canadian Coast Guard into a stewardship agreement, it tells you that this is about day-to-day on-the-water jurisdiction.
It's practical.
Highly practical. This agreement ensures that Musqueam knowledge and traditional stewardship practices will actively guide shared decision-making to protect the waters in their territory.
That makes a lot of sense.
It is taking thousands of years of environmental knowledge and integrating it directly into modern emergency management and marine safety protocols.
Wow.
It means if there is an oil spill or a search and rescue operation, the Musqueamer are legally embedded in the response framework.
Which leads perfectly into the third agreement, the fisheries agreement. And looking at the sources, this one seems to go far beyond just sharing ideas in a boardroom.
It does.
It includes concrete implementation funding. The federal government is providing funding for access, for vessels, and for gear.
Real hardware.
Yeah. The takeaway here is that Canada isn't just asking for Indigenous advice on fish stocks anymore. They are explicitly funding Indigenous enforcement and management.
It's a major shift.
A huge shift from mere consultation to actual co-management. Minister of Fisheries Joanne Thompson was actually quoted in the press release saying that Musqueam's knowledge of these waters runs deep, and integrating that knowledge is essential to protecting these fisheries for the generations that come after us.
That shift to co-management is the vital takeaway there. But we really need to look at the why behind all of this.
Okay.
Why does that first document, the 30-page rights recognition agreement, matter so much right now?
Why does it?
It matters because of the phrasing it uses regarding the future. It establishes what the government calls a framework for incremental implementation of rights, as well as a framework for nation-to-nation relations with Canada.
Incremental implementation.
Yes. That word incremental is doing a lot of heavy lifting in this legal text. It means this is not the final destination.
It's just the start.
It is the roadmap. It sets the rules of engagement for how Canada and the Musqueam will negotiate land and rights issues moving forward over the next several decades.
To put this in perspective for you, the listener, think about these three incremental agreements, not as the government suddenly handing over the keys to a house.
Good analogy.
Think of it rather as laying down a completely new operational foundation for a massive shared house. They are upgrading the plumbing and the security with the marine management agreement.
Right.
They are restocking and managing the pantry with the fisheries agreement. And they are writing down the constitutional house rules for the future with the rights agreement.
They aren't deciding who gets which bedroom just yet.
Exactly. They are making sure the house itself is standing on solid, mutually respected ground so they can actually build it together.
That is a highly accurate way to visualize the legal mechanics at play here. The foundation has to be set before you can address the specifics of the structure itself.
Definitely.
And those specifically where this house is located are exactly what have triggered such a massive public reaction over the past few days.
Here's where it gets really interesting, because we have to talk about the map.
The map is key.
The geography we are discussing here is absolutely staggering. According to the Canadian press reporting, the new agreement itself doesn't actually include a newly drawn map of the title area to scare everyone.
No, it doesn't.
But its preamble specifically references a historical 1976 Musqueam Declaration. And that 1976 declaration states that the nation's traditional territory spans Vancouver, Richmond, Burnaby, part of Delta, North Vancouver, and West Vancouver.
It's huge.
We are talking about the entire economic and population engine of British Columbia.
It is a massive swath of highly developed, incredibly expensive real estate. And if you are listening to this and you live in one of those areas, or especially if you own a home or a business there, you are likely experiencing a bit of whiplash right now.
Understandably so.
You are naturally asking yourself what a document recognizing Aboriginal title means for your mortgage, your backyard, or your commercial lease.
Yeah.
And that anxiety from the public isn't just coming out of nowhere. We have to look at the context provided by the Post Media article to understand the panic.
Right. There's recent history here.
Post Media points out that public confusion around Indigenous land claims in British Columbia really peaked last summer. That was when a BC Superior Court formally recognized the Cowichan Nation's title claims over some lands on Lulu Island.
I remember that making a lot of waves.
This was a massive deal because it seemingly overrode private property holders' rights on about 1,800 acres.
1,800 acres of private land.
So there is a very recent, very real legal precedent in the public memory for Indigenous title claims directly intersecting with private property.
Okay, but let me play devil's advocate for the listener here. If I'm a homeowner in Richmond and I hear the government just signed a deal that recognizes Aboriginal title over my city, a simple clarifying statement from a politician might not make me feel totally secure.
Of course not.
Especially with that Lulu Island situation fresh in my mind. Legally speaking, based on the sources we have, why should a homeowner actually trust that their private property isn't on the table right now?
It is a completely fair question.
Yeah.
And as the voice of reason here, we need to look strictly at what the text of the agreement actually says rather than the speculation surrounding it.
Sticking to the text.
Following the media storm over the weekend, the office of the Minister of Crown Indigenous Relations, Rebecca Alty, had to step in. They released a highly specific clarifying statement to the Canadian press.
And what did they say?
They explicitly confirmed that these specific agreements with the Musqueam First Nation do not have any effect whatsoever on privately owned land.
Which is a relief, but what does the actual 30-page document say to back that up?
What's fascinating here is the incredibly careful legal wording used in the rights agreement itself.
Okay.
The document explicitly states that it does not create, amend, establish, abrogate, or derogate from Musqueam title.
Wow.
Furthermore, it explicitly states that it does not constitute a treaty or a land claim. It is purely a general recognition of rights.
Wait, abrogate or derogate? That's heavy lawyer speak.
Very heavy.
For those of us without constitutional law degrees, does that just mean this specific agreement can't be used to cancel out or lessen their pre-existing rights? But it also doesn't immediately enforce them over someone's private backyard.
You're on the right track.
Can you break down the difference between what this is versus a treaty or a land claim?
I absolutely can. Let's translate that. Abrogate or derogate simply means to repeal or detract from. So the document says, this piece of paper doesn't magically create your rights, and it doesn't limit them either.
Got it.
A land claim or a treaty is a highly specific legal mechanism where a First Nation and the Crown legally define exactly who owns which specific parcel of land, often transferring title deeds or financial compensation.
So a very granular transaction.
Right. This agreement explicitly says it is not that. It is a general recognition.
Mm-hmm.
The minister's office clarified that the entire purpose of this agreement is simply to establish a framework for future negotiations.
So setting the table.
They're agreeing to sit at the table to figure out exactly how and where those rights and title could apply down the road. Private property is governed by fee simple title under the current Canadian system, and this incremental framework doesn't touch that system today.
So going back to our house analogy, they are acknowledging that the Musqueam have a rightful historical claim to be owners of the house.
Yes.
But they are explicitly stating that this particular piece of paper doesn't change anyone's current lease, it doesn't kick anyone out, and it isn't the final deed.
That's the key.
It's an agreement to sit down and negotiate the final deed later using a newly established set of rules.
Precisely. It is the agreement to negotiate, not the final settlement itself.
But as you can imagine, anything involving land, government negotiations, and highly complex legal documents is going to spark an absolute political firestorm.
Oh, inevitably.
It's worth noting the immediate political reaction this caused in early March. Now, we aren't here to play politics, but understanding the backlash from different sides of the aisle really helps explain why there was so much public confusion.
The context is important.
Looking at the reporting from the Canadian press and Post media, the pushback was immediate and intense. Conservative opposition members loudly demanded the full public release of the unredacted documents.
Right.
They accused the federal government of making massive generational commitments behind closed doors and argued that Canadians were being deliberately kept in the dark about agreements that could reshape their communities.
Those were the specific accusations.
The accusations of government secrecy were a major driving force behind the story catching fire in the first place.
And the controversy wasn't just isolated to the federal level in Ottawa. The response from the provincial government in British Columbia added another massive layer of confusion to the mix.
Yeah, that was strange.
According to the reporting, BC Premier David Eby was asked about the agreements at an unrelated press event. His initial response was quite baffling. He stated that he had not been briefed on the agreements, though he added he wasn't surprised that the negotiations had taken place.
Which is wild to think about. A landmark deal covering his entire metropolitan base, the economic hub of his province, is signed, and the premier says he wasn't briefed on the details.
It definitely fueled the opposition's narrative that this was done in secret. But then, very shortly after that press conference, Premier Eby's office had to issue a hasty, somewhat embarrassing clarification.
They had to walk it back.
They confirmed that Eby did, in fact, attend the February 20 signing ceremony in person, in his capacity as the local member of the Legislative Assembly. His office released a firm statement saying, "This was not done in secret."
That is quite the political walk back, going from "I wasn't briefed on this" to "I was literally in the room when the pens hit the paper."
This raises an important question for you to consider as a consumer of daily news. How do governments effectively communicate highly complex, legally nuanced frameworks to the general public in a highly polarized political environment?
It's incredibly difficult.
When an agreement takes 10 years to negotiate, involves shifting constitutional frameworks, and utilizes highly specific legal terminology like abrogate or derogate, dropping it into a standard press release on a Friday essentially guarantees confusion.
A Friday news dump.
Exactly. The gap between the actual signing on February 20 and the media explosion in early March perfectly illustrates what happens when complex policy meets the modern information vacuum.
People fill the void.
People will naturally fill that vacuum with their greatest anxieties. And in this case, the greatest anxiety was the security of their private property.
So what does this all mean? We've talked about the mechanics of the three agreements, we've untangled the very real confusion around private property, and we've navigated the political drama and miscommunications.
You've covered a lot of ground.
But how does this fit into the history of Canada and Indigenous relations as a whole? Because this didn't just happen overnight.
To understand the true impact, we have to zoom out and look at the broader context provided by the sources. This wasn't a sudden, isolated event drafted up over a weekend to grab a headline.
It's far from it.
The government press release notes that these agreements are the result of more than 10 years of deep discussions, collaboration, and negotiation. It dates all the way back to the establishment of a formal reconciliation table in 2016.
10 years in the making.
And it is part of a very deliberate recent sequence of events. These agreements directly follow the revenue sharing agreement for the Vancouver International Airport that was signed in February 2025.
Right.
And the initialing of the Musqueam self-government agreement in March 2025. This is a very steady, very deliberate drumbeat of expanding recognition and self-determination over the last decade.
One of the details in the government press release that really stood out to me was the explicit recognition of the Musqueam's own legal framework.
Yes.
The document specifically names their manners and customs, their Smo Iya and Shistimo. It names these as the fundamental underpinnings of their distinct social structure, governance, decision-making, and legal system.
That's a crucial point.
It isn't just Canada saying, we will benevolently apply Canadian law to protect your interests. It is Canada legally saying, we recognize your traditional laws are valid, and they exist alongside ours.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, you are hitting on what is arguably the most transformative concept in all of these sources. It is the concept of legal pluralism.
Legal pluralism.
Legal pluralism is the idea that multiple legal systems can exist, operate, and be respected within the exact same geographic space.
Interesting.
For over a century, the assumption was that Canadian constitutional law superseded everything else. Full stop. What these agreements do is formally declare that Canadian constitutional law and Musqueam traditional governance can coexist. They can intertwine to guide shared decision-making.
Can you give us a tangible example of what that intertwining actually looks like in practice? Because legal pluralism sounds great in a sociology classroom, but how does it work on the water?
Think back to the Marine Management Agreement. If the Coast Guard is planning to establish a new shipping lane or emergency response protocol, they aren't just looking at Canadian federal maritime law anymore.
Okay.
Under legal pluralism, a traditional Musqueam custom regarding environmental stewardship or seasonal fishing routes, their sign HUM, carries legal weight in that planning process.
So they have to look at both rule books.
The two systems have to be reconciled to make a final operational decision. Musqueam's lead negotiator, Wendy Grantjohn, emphasized in the release that Musqueam is committed to continuing to honor and implement these traditional governance practices to chart their path forward.
It's not just theory.
Legal pluralism isn't just an academic theory anymore. It is actively becoming the operational reality in Greater Vancouver.
And looking at the sources, it seems like the Musqueam leadership is incredibly optimistic about what this shared reality looks like for everyone involved.
Very much so.
Chief Wayne Sparrow was quoted in the release, and his words really frame this as a victory for the entire region, not just the First Nation. He said the community celebrates this as a step forward on their path to reconciliation.
A shared victory.
But he also highlighted that this is an innovative approach to agreements, one that actively benefits the greater community and contributes to a joint sustainable future.
Joint being the operative word.
He's looking at this as a way to use their recognized title, their traditional laws, and their deep environmental expertise to build a better, safer, more resilient region for everyone who lives there, Indigenous or not.
It is a profound shift in perspective. It moves the conversation away from a zero-sum game.
Where one side's win is the other's loss.
Right, where one side's legal gain is automatically perceived as the other side's loss, which is exactly what caused the private property panic in the first place.
Exactly.
And it moves it towards a framework of mutual benefit. It is genuine co-management of resources and territory.
Which brings us to the end of our journey today. We've taken a massive amount of dense, confusing, and politically charged information and synthesized it down to the essentials.
And there was a lot of it.
So you now know that while these historic agreements between Ottawa and the Musqueam Indian Band do cover a massive swath of Greater Vancouver, and they do officially recognize Aboriginal rights and title, they are not a sudden seizure of your private property.
That is the core takeaway.
They are carefully worded, incremental frameworks designed to establish a foundation for shared stewardship, tangible marine management with the Coast Guard, and future nation-to-nation negotiations.
Just setting the foundation.
You know that the political noise, while loud and sometimes contradictory, often obscures the highly specific legal reality of what the documents actually say.
As we wrap up this deep dive into the sources, I want to leave you with a final thought to mull over on your own. It's something that builds on the fundamental legal shift we've analyzed today. The rights agreement explicitly notes that both parties intend for this document to contribute to the implementation of the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples.
UNDREP.
Furthermore, the documents repeatedly recognize Aboriginal title as something that has existed since time immemorial. They do not say the Canadian government is creating or granting these rights today.
Oh, that's a huge distinction.
They explicitly say the government is finally recognizing rights that have always been there, predating the country itself. So if Canadian constitutional law is fundamental,